AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
The book is called My Glorious Defeats, Activist, Narcissist, Anonymous, after a series of escapades, that's the way of putting it, here online that brought him in and out of 4chan's forums, the halls of power, and federal prison. Barrett Brown is a free man. He's written a book about his glorious defeats. Delighted to say that joining me live on the line from somewhere in that there, London, is the man himself, Barrett Brown. Barrett, good morning to you. Impressed by the cigar, sir?
Good morning to you. Actually, it's a very advanced cigarette thing that it basically solves smoking now. It's called a Eidos or something, and it's tobacco, but it just heats up, it vaporizes, it's wonderful.
Marvelous. So
excited to have you.
Exactly. For those who don't know, just explain a little bit about what you're doing in London, if you can, if it's not too illegal, immoral, or fattening, and a little behind your career so far, as it were.
Sure. So I was a fairly standard journalist back in the day. Wrote for fairly standard outlets in the U.S. and U.K. That rhymed, unfortunately. And then I got more and more militant as I saw more and more about how the press works or how it doesn't work, how easily it's manipulated, how organically it fails to do basic duties in a free society. And so when 2010 rolled around, WikiLeaks sort of launched the whole aggressive transparency movements. And then when Anonymous, this sort of movement that was, it was kind of a subculture, a prank culture, then it became something else. It became something much more aggressive and activist. When those things occurred, I was in a position to get involved. I was recruited onto a server where the Tunisian Revolution was being partly managed by Tunisian nationals in Tunisia, as well as other of us across the world. And the Arab Spring sort of launched from that. Tunisia was a success. We found out we were being spied upon by a number of intelligence agencies, contractors, ex-military intelligence, you know, these firms, FBI, and we caught some of them. And we weren't very happy about them interfering with what we considered, what everyone considered, I think, except for them, to be a very legitimate exercise in helping to spread democracy, something that our governments are always claiming that they want to do. So we went after them. We went after the CIA, NSA, Palantir, Peter Thiel, NQTEL, all these little agencies, some well-known, some not, Booz Allen Hamilton, which is where Snowden later came from. And we had, there was an aggressive campaign where they were coming after us, we were coming after them, Congress got involved, a lot of investigations. And so the FBI eventually, they spent a long time trying to figure out what to get me on, because I'm not a hacker. You wouldn't know if the New York Times headline review the other day, or the Kirkus Review headline, or the New Republic review, but I've never been a hacker. I can't code, don't like computers, don't like hackers either. I've always been a writer and sort of a militant activist and so forth. So the FBI did finally figure out some fake charges to put on me, and they raided me at my house. They raided my mom's house, and I didn't like that. And I told them that, and I was very aggressive about what was going to happen if they came back to my mom's house. So they came and arrested me with the SWAT team. And then I was facing 105 years worth of charges, most of which would be dropped later on, since they were just, you know, they were made for the purpose of trying to get me to cooperate, which most people did, unfortunately. So I'm kind of the last man standing. I got out of prison in 2016. Some people are dead. A lot of people have been turned. They've been co-opted by these same networks, these same intelligence networks in the U.S. and U.K. and elsewhere. And so what we've been doing is kind of the same thing. We've been kind of been putting out, trying to aggressively pursue these same organizations, these same agencies, these same practices that have been that have contributed so much to what's gone wrong in the Western world in the last 15 years.
Just dialing it back a bit, because you said you left the established media because they weren't doing the job. Do you think that modern media has become too much on the PR spin? They don't ask the questions, they go for the soft option, and they don't do the leather work?
Yes, but I don't even think that's the worst part of it by any means. I think the worst part is you have a lot of laziness, you have a lot of careerism, you have a lot of cowardice, you've got a lot of incompetence. You got these kids going to Columbia University journalism school, and then they go to the New York Times. They don't really know anything, and they don't really have to. Until you're covered by the press, or the press is covering something that you have documents on, you know about, it's really hard to see how pervasive this is. And it's also really hard to see how easy it is for these agencies to manipulate the press, to buy off particular reporters, as they have with a number of people I've mentioned in my book and so forth. And you just gradually kind of see that these problems in terms of the intelligence community using both the right and the left to maintain certain power structures, it's a problem that the press will not solve on its own. It's a problem that's going to have to be solved by something, sort of an apparatus that is very cognizant of these things and very aggressive about them and very self-confident in asserting what is right and what is wrong. And the fact that these opponents of ours, the government, press, whatever, the fact that they're always hiding what they're doing, the fact that they're never able to explain it, the fact that it always looks bad when it comes out, I think that gives us a moral foundation to respond to their violence, respond to their dishonesty, respond to their brutalism with a little bit of the same.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Cairo, the Egyptian Spring, the Arab Spring, and you're in Tunisia. And when these reports were coming out, for example, of Syria and other places, people saying, this is marvelous, this is what the internet's for, it's real journalism, let's applaud these guys. And then when they don't like it, suddenly you find yourself being, I mean, and as a journalist, how do you find that as a journalist online? Because I get this a lot of times, people saying, oh, well, this is the new media. But as a trained journalist, you have to, there's some people out there who haven't done perhaps the same sort of training that you have, Barrett.
Well, the sad thing is I am on training. I went to college for about 3 months before I got sick of it. It's not hard to do journalism if you can do thinking, if you can read it, and if you are aggressive about going after those things. So as for the Arab Spring and all these other issues, what happens is it's a reflection of our own failures as a society, where everybody it doesn't cost anything to be wrong. It doesn't cost anything to say, oh, that thing over there is happening is great, and it reflects why I'm right about something, whether it be Syria, whatever. And if it changes, then it's like, oh, I never said that, and blah blah. It's just so easy to protect our egos, protect our self-perceptions. And it's very, especially easy for reporters to do that because they can't afford to be caught being wrong over and over again. Otherwise, they'll be found to be useless. So new media, old media, whatever, it's all the same dynamics keep applying. Oftentimes, there are some differences here and there. But it basically comes down to, you know, we have regulations for things. We have negative feedback in machines. We have policies, you know, at your radio station. If you were to come in every day drunk and yelling out, you know, let's bomb France, you know, eventually they'd be like, hey, you got to stop that or something like that. That's not how it is. The New York Times or the London Times, you know, all these things, people keep getting caught engaging in things that are immoral by any standard, that are indefensible, that they can't defend in terms of working with the intelligence community, not printing retractions when they inevitably get conned by intelligence agencies or companies or just PR people. There's no reason for the New York Times to be like, hey, you know, we screwed this up on a huge scale. We ran this story that was absolutely false. It contributed to a couple of wars, and we're sorry, and we're not going to let it happen again. No one cares. No one's going to stop reading the New York Times. I mean, some people do. I'm not trying to pick on the New York Times, mm-hmm. by the way. I'm just standing. I mean, I am trying to pick on them, but we don't have the structures in place. We don't have the civic structures. We're not like the Republican Romans, you know, who were like, let's, you know, come tell their children, come back with your shield or on it. We are the opposite. We're a very comfortable post-war society in which no one takes responsibility for anything, and that works for them. And so sociopaths and mediocrities continue to rise, and people who try to point to these structures and try to show the powerful people and the not so powerful people who keep screwing us over and over again we tend to be marginalized as a result. And that can take forms of getting a SWAT team to your house, and then you go to prison for many years, and you're put under a gag order like I was, and your friends keep getting found dead, and intel contractors keep approaching everyone in your family, or it can take much more subtle forms, as it does for most people. So the great thing about my story is it's so well documented, and there's so much to be learned from it in terms of how these things work and why things don't work.
A lot of people, if they were getting hit on by the government agencies, would have just put their head down and gone, right, okay, game over, don't want to do it anymore. Was there this sort of were you indignant and saying, okay, well, we're going to go after you as well because this isn't right? And I'm thinking sort of counterculture 1960s Gonzo journalism. I'm thinking, look at the shirt, Hunter S. Thompson. I mean, that sort of approach to, fear and loathing on the campaign trail, don't believe the hype, etc. Was that why you decided to go back aggressively at them?
It was more that I was a very eccentric child and I didn't have any religion or ideology. I wasn't taught anything. I read Dune and Isaac Asimov and all that and pieced together my own very aggressive, very non 20th century ideology from that. And then I had the opportunity. I was lucky in some ways to to have the chance to be so aggressive against these agencies. And I have some kind of pathology. I think I really, it's clear that I'm pretty nutty in some ways. I'm very happy to be the one, to be one of those who aggressively pursues these people over and over again and takes on more fights. I enjoy it. It's what I like to do. It's my hobby.
So what was the sentence? 105 years they were going to give you.
That was the total exposure of all the charges I was facing in 2013. And so that got a lot of headlines. I mean, realistically, I was only facing probably about 30 or 40 years. But 105 was all the charges, the maximum together,
How do you compute that when you've got literally the government, the man sticking it to you then? And, did you actually at any point think, hang on a second, this perhaps wasn't the best move that I've made? Or are you steadfast in the convictions that you had?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was one time when someone brought in some weed, which we didn't have much of at that jail unit, and we smoked some. And I was that night, I was sitting there thinking, what the hell? What am I doing, man? Why am I in prison based 100 bucks? What's wrong with me? Why am I going to keep going to war with all these, the CIA and so forth, over and over again? And, and the next day I was like, whatever. Here we are. I mean, both my grandfathers were bomber leaders in World War II and did different theaters. I mean, one of them almost got shot at the plane. A parachute caught on the door, they got to fly. I mean, just that was normal back then. That's the thing. This was normal. It was normal to be like, I'm going to go put myself on the front lines. The problem is we're not being told to do that anymore. And when we are, it's for the wrong reasons. So I'm trying to lead by example and say that, look, this isn't hard, actually. This is these agencies, these governments, these corrupt, these corporations that keep getting caught trying to manage democracy. They're not that powerful. They have lots of chinks in their armor. They don't get challenged really that much. And so it's like someone who's never been in a fight. When the fight starts, they don't really know what to do. And they screw around, they get caught doing more stuff. And then, the U.S. press freedom rankings plummet as they did because of my case and a few others. You have to be aggressive. You don't win wars by, as Patton said, I don't want to hear anybody talking about holding ground. You let the Huns do that. I want to be gaining ground every time. We're gonna grease the treads of our tanks with their guts. That's how you win wars.
What do you think about the situation at the moment where we have people, you are either with us or against us? There doesn't seem to be any nuance anymore.
That doesn't sound very nuanced. I mean, it's I heard it before in America. I remember the U.S. That was our slogan for a little while back in 2003, 2004. And it was part of, I'm not opposed to that idea in theory, but it's oftentimes used in ways like that are not appropriate for operations that aren't really being properly conveyed to us in terms of what they actually are. So I think it's a dangerous sentiment to have when so much of our public policy and our information media is just inherently crazy and irresponsible. I think it's, that's, but I mean, I don't feel that way. I don't feel that anyone is as an obligation to be with our side, our faction. I think that they should take a look at what we're doing and decide for themselves, are they being led down a bad path by someone on the right or someone on the left who may or may not be under the umbrella of these intelligence agencies. And a lot of them turn out to be. That's the thing. A lot of them, I used to be very naive about that, ironically. And we have all these journalists we work with. We do all this research. We've spent 10 years, you know, going after a certain single person in many cases, and we keep turning up the same entities over and over again. And it's becoming clearer and clearer. Just a few days ago, 404 Media just ran an article on this DDoS, this distributed denial of secrets organization that's being run by ex-military counterintelligence people, FBI guys who got done up on child pornography and then became assets, really sick people. They've been representing themselves as a transparency group that does what we do. And they've been attacking me and my network of people and journalists and putting out this information for years and years, working with the CIA, working with Peter Thiel of Palantir, working with GCHQ, and taking up a space that should be better occupied by people who are honest and not chomos, not nonsense, which these people tend to be. So we're finally in a chance where we're pushing them back, we're rolling them back, we're identifying their membership. The regular press is now realizing what's going on, so it's working out. I think we're winning at this point.
Personally, don't you sort of think, hang on, we're taking on, you know, you've already revealed various nefarious dealings. Are you ever worried for yourself personally at this point, Barrett? Because you are high profile. When the books come out, you are the best known figure in this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. A number of my colleagues we've worked with on these things, including Michael Hastings, Aaron Swartz, Kevin Gallagher, and Val Brokesman, who himself turned out to have been turned by the FBI and was found dead about 2 years ago. People die. Sometimes they die because of suicide, because they've been a lot of the stuff that happens to us is sort of covert. It's hard to talk about because people don't really understand it. You can't say, oh, the CIA is after me, you know, and doing all this stuff. Or these people are approaching all of my family members under different names and threatening them. And it's just something that, unfortunately, because so many of these assets work with different reporters and different outlets, those outlets, they're now in an embarrassing situation. Where, you know, they don't want to admit, oh, this person that's been my disinformation researcher I work with, you know, like the Washington Post has Joseph Mann and he works with Neil Rauhauser, who's an FBI asset. They don't want to admit, okay, yeah, these guys have been engaged in a very, really disturbing operation involving child pornography and blackmail for years and years. They don't want to admit that. It would cause people to question, and it would cause a lot of questions. I'll put it that way. So yeah, I'm always concerned, but mostly for the people around me. That's how they get to you. I mean, they watch you, they study you, they learn what your weaknesses are, what buttons to push.
That would be the CIA.
Yeah, they know it's actually a package, I think. And so they find ways. They're not going to kill me, I don't think, because it's just not. I don't think it's good, especially now that the book is out. Now that you know, what they do is disinformation. What they do is just spread it to you. They just make it so it doesn't matter what you know. It doesn't matter what you can prove. They encircle you, basically, with assets operating on certain tactics so as to make it so that if you go and give a talk somewhere or if you're in touch with a newspaper, they will reach out to that newspaper under some name and say, oh, look, this Barrett Brown guy, he's a rapist. You know, and then a year later, it'll be something else. None of these things are true. They don't have to be true. All they have to do is force or trick a reporter or a government official or someone into taking an overt act against someone like myself, who later turns out to be considered a hero by other people. Those people are now part of it. They now have an impetus to not pursue this. In fact, they have a very strong impetus. And that's kind of what's happened. It's amazing the book actually came out. It took years and years. There was bizarre legal things in the background. This lawyer for all these child pornography purveyors, Stanley Cohen in New York, this guy, you know, has interfered over and over again. Joseph Mann at the Washington Post, who's our national security reporter, he interfered. He obtained a copy of my manuscript from my now dead colleague, Kevin Gallagher. All of these things have happened, some of which we know about, some of which we'll perhaps find out about soon. And that's really how they do it. They don't necessarily want you dead. They just want you to not matter, to not be able to be a threat to them. But right now they are. And we have been very aggressive in the last couple of weeks. I mean, this network of people I work with, some of whom are very well known, some of whom are not. We have been sort of laying low for the last 2 years or so. And then we've just very recently stepped up a very aggressive campaign all at once so that they don't have the ability to destabilize us any further or to protect themselves. And now a lot of people are being outed in the press, that, you know, aside from us. And a lot of what they're doing has been outed. And it's going to be kind of a bloodbath. going forward.
The book itself, was it a, did you write it over a period of time then? It wasn't just, you know, you sat down with a laptop and in a cabin in New Jersey, sort of New Hampshire.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's part of it. Parts of it I wrote in prison. Parts of it, you know, I knew how I was going to write about it later, you know, when it happened. Like, there'll be incidents. I'm like, oh, this is funny. I'll definitely, you know, phrase it this way. And then, I signed the deal for the book right when I got, when I was in a halfway house after I got out of prison, and then started work, you know, and then wrote most of it over the next 2 years. Then things kept, we kept learning new things that made the book had to change. And we kept learning new things about Glenn Greenwald, who recruited me to write for a news outlet that turned out to be another intelligence front. And that's something that's probably coming out. That's a book by Eon Higgins, E-I-O-N, I don't know how you pronounce his name, coming out early next year, about how they've been doing this, how Peter Thiel, Pierre Omidyar, and Elon Musk have been basically capturing journalists and news outlets on both the left and the right in order to manage the movements and subvert it and turn it to different ends. This Peter Thiel guy, he is the most disgusting. He is the most powerful. He's the most powerful person in the world, in a way, because his company, Palantir, and his 20 other companies, they pick who the vice president's going to be. J.D. Vance, the guy who Trump just picked, that's a former Peter Thiel employee. From one of his capital firms. They did the NSA, your data, that all goes to Palantir. The UN refugee information all goes to Palantir. The CIA, FBI, all of these intelligence agencies in different countries, they all use Palantir software. They use Palantir's data management. And Palantir is a firm that's been caught over and over again since 2011 when we first caught them, subverting democracy, blackmailing journalists, investigating people's children to gain leverage. I mean, this came out, Congress investigated it, it was shut down by the DOJ. And that's really what this tracks back to. It all tracks back to Palantir and Peter Thiel and the massive amounts of power that they have managed to accrue among a few billionaires and a bunch of sort of lieutenants like David Sachs and so forth. And they've basically applied counterinsurgency and different intelligence doctrines on a large scale using technology, using the internet. And they have been very successful in rearranging the world to what they, to something they explicitly talk about what they want, the dark enlightenment, a post-democratic world run by basically essentially ketamine addicted billionaires. It's not something that it's not like Hitler. It's hard to see it.
When you uncover something like this and the way it's all interlinked, Do you just sort of have a wry smile and say, right, we go for it? Does it give more juice to your investigations? Because a lot of people just say, oh, we're against the whole lot and walk away. But this is rocket fuel for you, presumably, Barrett.
Yeah, although the way we go, but I mean, we've had to learn. I mean, very few of us, in fact, almost none of us have any intelligence training. There were some people who came in that we worked with, and some who were pretty prominent who were famously, you know, whistleblowers and all that ex-NSA, but they have all turned out to be disappointing and pretty prone to bad behavior. So we've had to kind of figure out when we have information, it's the easy part is getting the information. The easy part is saying this guy's connected to this person and they're doing this. The hard part is figuring out who is not embarrassed by this information. The Washington Post, New York Times, who will run this? Who's not threatened by it because, let's say, Reuters has this deal with Palantir and they don't want, you know, who, where can we go with this? So basically, you're like a guy running into a village saying, hey, these wolves are attacking. And someone in the village is like, ah, you're silly, and shoots you with an arrow. And then, you know, and then you're like, hey, that guy seems to be trying to sway this. And like, oh, you're just complaining about your arrow. You're just mad because of the arrow. It's like, no, I want to tell you about the wolves. And I think that guy's suspicious because he keeps shooting people with arrows when they come and tell you stuff. And then it turns out he's got, you know, and here's all of his emails with the FBI, you know, and just it's like pulling teeth trying to get this stuff. But again, that is changing. It is changing. And I don't think our opposite numbers and then military intelligence and Black Cube, these firms that are used to help cover up sexual misconduct by producers and Hollywood people. I don't think they've thrown everything they have. They've shot their wad, as it were. I don't think they're prepared for what's coming up, because no one is. A lot of this is unprecedented, this kind of warfare. And it is warfare. It's what we have built. We have psyops, we have military intelligence. These things exist. There's doctrine. I mean, our opposite number are generally military. Out of bases in the U.S., U.K., and a few others, and of course Russia and China, because there's a lot of very intrigue going on. you know, it's just, it's the same old thing as it always has been with the intelligence community. But it's always a matter of figuring out how can we get people, how can we beg people to look at this information that people have died to bring them? How can we beg them not to look away from it because it implicates, because it makes them look a little bit bad? A journalist's own career, and this, we see this over and over again, is almost always more important to that journalist than anything else. Sociopaths rise in business, corporations, government. They also rise in journalism, and they also rise sometimes in activism. And so we always have to be wary of making people heroes. You know,
why My Glorious Defeats, Barrett? Why the title there?
So the way, what I originally, my doctrine, one of my doctrines I've developed in terms of counterinsurgency or counterintelligence, whatever you want to call it, is that planning is I guess okay in some circumstances, but really the best way to go about things is to improvise. And every time something goes wrong, figure out how can we use this to our advantage. If you're able to do that consistently, like I went to prison. Okay, so now I'm writing this column. I'm winning all the national magazine awards and all that. I'm charming people with my funny, cute prison columns. I'm putting in a little bit of information here and there about some things. You know, okay, it's an advantage now. It's a defeat, but now it's something else. Over and over again. So that's, and it's also sort of a nod to the fact that despite all of the things that have done, all these remarkable things that have happened in the public eye that we've been involved in, that used to get so much press attention, it hasn't really mattered because we're talking to a public that just really doesn't care. And we're talking to a press that doesn't care and is probably compromised. And so, but ultimately what we have to get to, what we're trying to get to, is a point where we change the whole terms of this whole engagement. It's no longer about, we're going to beg people to stop going after our family members. We're going to get to a point where they're going to be begging us, as some of them are, to not go forward with the information we have on them. And that's what's happening right now. That's the phase we're at. So it's, and those are things that we'll be able to explain more about in the coming weeks. I'm giving a talk at Frontline Club in London. It's a journalism club on September 16th. And a lot of, a number of things that we've just, for those reasons that we've just sort of stopped trying to make public, will become public at that point, as they already have in the last few days in this article on 404 Media about DDoS and their child pornography networks and so forth.
If people want to follow you online, I'm going to run out of time, unfortunately. If people want to follow you online, find you online, where's the best place to see what you're up to, Barrett?
Yeah, the best place is on Twitter. My name there is PROJPM, Project PM. That was my organization, the DOJ, Deemed a Criminal Organization. That's my Twitter account, and that's where I put out the things that we're making public, and the things that others have made public and so forth. So that's the best place. If you want to know what's going on and why, that would be a good place to start. And people, aside from my book, people should be reading Tip of the Spear, which is a book about the Attica prison revolt and about incarceral revolution. That's, we draw a lot of doctrine from these things. I mean, we draw it from all over. We draw it from the Kurdish anarchists. We draw it from Spanish Civil War. We draw from the CIA's early days. I mean, we draw it from prison insurrections. And that's why we've been so effective. And that's why we've had so much trouble from the various federales.
The book is called My Glorious Defeats. You can also order it via our own virtual bookstore. It's by Barrett Brown, who we're speaking to today. Barrett, it's been, my mind is blown. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
You as well. Thank you very much.
Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.